All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hearing ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio, now in open session, moving to adjournment.
Good morning. You may be seated. First case in our calendar is the 1074 State of Ohio versus Stanley Jackson.
Oh, he's yours. You did what he wanted done.
Mr. Chief Justice Moyer, Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Nathan Ray, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Stanley J. Wallace. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This morning, Your Honor, I would like to focus the court on the first two issues that I raised, or that the world raised, in the brief before this court for proposition of law, that dealing with the issue of deciding why the proof of the person in the United States, and then the evidence that was admitted throughout the trial under 801 dealing with the conspiracy, alleged conspiracy that transpired in this case. What I'd like to do first is to start out with the fact that I addressed in the brief, and that is this issue was not objected to in the trial court. It was not briefed in the Court of Appeal. I did brief it before this court under the plain error review. This court does have the opportunity to review if there's a substantial right that's been afforded to the United States defendant. The court press can review it under that area of the law. I'm reading this for this court. Specifically, in 1994, this court decided the State versus Gilliam, which addressed this issue. Subsequently to that, Mr. Doyle was tried, and then there was another decision that came out of the U.S. Supreme Court, Lilly versus Virginia, and then this court decided a minute ago, earlier this year. Even if we look at Gilliam, which was on point in this case, dealing with the admission of, or the introduction of a co-defendant statement that the co-defendant did not testify, Gilliam is distinguishable on this basis. The court relied on Gilliam on 803. 803 is an exception to the hearsay rule. Specifically, in Gilliam, the court of the prosecution called for the court to testify the defendant asserted his Fifth Amendment right. Counsel, and on that basis, the court in Gilliam said, well, there was a finding of unavailability, therefore it was 803. In this case, that never happened. Rubin came up in the opening statements, and Rubin came up with the sentencing phase of this trial. He came up with the opening statement by the prosecution, in which he indicated that Ronald Smith, who was put in the case, had stated that Kevin Doyle was with him on the night of the murder, participated in the murder. The brute problem came up in sentencing and just argued that this was rebuttal evidence. The brute problem in this case does not rise to the level of rebuttal evidence. Specifically, there was no finding by the court of unavailability, therefore this is not the 03 assessment, therefore even under Gilliam, this evidence should not have been admitted in the phase of this trial. As I indicated earlier this year, the court decided to manage the line on Lilly versus Virginia. And those two cases are clearly on point with the argument that we need to hear. Specifically, that you have a finding or a statement by a co-defendant coming in a trial where the co-defendant says, I was involved in this, but hey, Stanley Wallow was there with me, he was just as guilty as I am. And that the court has found both in Lilly and both in Manigault was inadmissible. And basically what Manigault ever did was it reversed that portion of Gilliam dealing with the 803 exception. All that being said, then we have to look at whether or not this raised the level of plain error in this case. Plain error requires or we look to whether or not there's a substantial right of an individual that's been violated. Lilly was very strong in his decision on the right of confrontation, as was Manigault in this, in this court's decision, if the right compensation has to be there in order for there to be, in order for a defendant to receive a fair trial. Under Vanderbilt, you no longer look at 803. You do look at the trustworthiness of the statement at the time the statement was given. And with those factors in mind in this case, I don't believe that there is any indicia of trustworthiness that is required by the courts. Based on that, even under Gilliam, the statements should have been objected to. They weren't. They should not have been admitted. They were admitted at the sentencing phase. And I think that simply because they're admitted at the sentencing phase does not increase the requirement of the right to compensation that the Sixth Amendment affords to an individual. And in this case, because that evidence did come in, there was a violation of the compensation clause. And as such, it violated the constitutional right to support the federal defendant in both the U.S. Constitution and the Ohio Constitution.
Does that complete your argument on that point?
Basically, sir, yes.
Can we move to propositional law number three, please? The sufficiency question. Is... Okay, sir. It's on page 13 of your brief. Your proposition states that the evidence is insufficient to sustain a conviction. I have two questions. One, I'd like to know what part of all of this evidence with an eyewitness and others that were there is insufficient, and secondly, is venue an evidentiary question?
Let me address your first part first, Justice Douglas. With regards to the sufficiency question, let me put it like this. I think there's two strong points of this case, okay, for the prosecution. And two things the defense had to overcome. Number one was the problem of group. Even at the initial opening statement, you know, the prosecution don't say, you know what, we have a co-defendant who admitted this guy was whipping, you have a problem right from the start. Most important, even more important than that, excuse me, back to the 801 argument, is all the other evidence that came on under 801 with regards to the last conspiracy in this case. Without those two things, you don't have a very strong case, and those are the things that you want.
Well, but we have those two things.
We do have those two things, okay. Unfortunately. And my argument is twofold. It's number one, that in and of itself should be reversible error in this case because that's going to come in violation of the law. Sufficiency, if it doesn't come in, then the sufficiency argument goes to people testifying against Mr. Chihuahua, like Michael Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a perspective. Danny Smith goes to the police originally. He's a co-defendant. Then Raymond Smith, who was a co-defendant, goes to the police. Danny Smith never acknowledges his involvement. Raymond Smith, the first time, doesn't acknowledge his involvement. He only says three people are in the car. Then you get to later on where Raymond Smith makes a subsequent statement to the police. He says, oh, by the way, Stanley Chihuahua was there. After that, Michael Smith comes involved.
Yeah, he came involved, and he was there.
Allegedly, he was there.
Well, it was pretty descriptive about backing the car up three times after the man had been beaten and running over him three times.
But Justice Douglas, let me point out a fact to you. It's important to note that Michael Smith did not become involved until after Danny Smith had been indicted in this case. At that point in time, they needed a way to get Danny Smith off the hook. And it's important to note that Danny Smith was initially acquitted of this charge. So you have Raymond Smith, who allegedly was there, who said, hey, Stanley Chihuahua was there. You have Michael Smith, who was never indicted, who says, hey, I was there. Then you have Danny Smith, who makes all these incriminating statements, who was acquitted. So I guess the sufficiency of the argument is if you look at all the surrounding evidence, you take that away. I mean, I think there's certainly a question of credibility, given the facts in this case, because Raymond Smith and Michael Smith and Daisy. Then you look at the fact that other than Raymond Smith, no one can place that allegedly Michael Smith. Those two people, I agree with you, Justice Douglas. Other than that, There's no one that can tie him into this case specifically. We have statements that Stanley said this as far as not being running over. I mean, we have one that said that.
Is the point you're making that Michael Smith was trying to protect his brother and his father?
I mean, I think if you look at the facts,
the things he said about his father there, that, you know, he involved his father more directly than I would have thought.
Let me just say that,
go ahead, sir.
But let me take a step back and say that my review of this case, I think that it would be safe to say that at least Michael Smith was attempting to absolve his brother of any wrongdoing in this case. It worked, he was good. So I think at least, you know, did you have Raymond Smith saying there's three people in the car, didn't you have Raymond Smith saying it? Stanley involved, then you have Michael Smith coming close to the car. Everybody's been indicted and say, oh, I was the fourth person in the car. After you originally have Raymond Smith saying, no, there's three people in the car. So I think that factor is itself. Oh, and obviously that goes to the way of the credibility of the witnesses, and that's a question for the jury. Mm-hmm. Or can review these on sufficiency of the way argument.
Okay, what about venue?
My
doesn't seem to me that's an element of the crime.
It is. I would agree with you that under Ohio law, it's an element of the crime. It has to be proven, you know, the reasons doubt by the prosecution in this case. I think, once again, if you look at the facts that come in with regards to, and I think that if you're going to believe Michael Smith, you're not going to believe Michael Smith testifies at trial that there was no indication that Stanley DeWall was threatening. There was no indication Stanley DeWall was in control. There was no indication Stanley was in any way involved with the murder of this case until after they were entitled to come. And that's where the proper thing should have lied in this case. If this has been a kidnapping case, which it was not indicted as a kidnapping case, there might be an argument about continuing course of conduct. This was not a kidnapping case. This was a straight murder case.
Couldn't a reasonable person, however, believe that the murder was concocted, planned, organized in the county of venue here, as opposed to just thinking that they really were just going to go, whatever it is, get a bus trip to Florida or take them to Cleveland or something? I mean, it was pretty obvious what was happening, wasn't it, among them before they ever picked him up?
Well, let me address that like this. I think the facts supported it. Sure, there could be a continuing course of conduct, but I don't think the facts supported it. The one person that could have really nailed this down, Raymond Smith, that testified just as his admissions came in under private scrutiny. Nanny Smith was only the person who was in the car with him, and his statement was, there was never any discussion that we're going to take this guy out and kill him. And as a matter of fact, we pulled him to the cemetery. Raymond Smith got Ron Miley out of the car, and at that point in time, he shot him. He came back to the car and said, hey, I need some help here from that. And allegedly, after that, Stanley got out of the car. So initially, I don't think there was an indication or knowledge that Stanley was involved when the murder was in place. I believe that, based upon all the facts that I remember, that this was simply an attempt to get Ron Miley light out of town based on the fact that he was going to testify about him there. So I don't think there was a continuing course of conduct. I don't think the evidence supports him. I mean, you couldn't believe Michael Smith at all. You're going to have to believe him when he says, hey, there was nothing going on. There was no threats made, and his testimony specifically, there was no threats between Sam White, which is James Wallowick, and the victim in this case. I mean, he's down for gas, and Smith is out of the car, takes a gun, goes to the gas station, pays for the taxi. And all that factor is there.
I know that this isn't part of the record, but what do you think? Why do you think this case was not indicted and tried in Cuyahoga County? What would your reason for that be, you think?
I guess it's purely speculation, but I don't know. Probably because of the fact that the victim resided in Lorain County and they wanted to be jurisdiction in this case. I mean, the only thing that I can think of, it was a drug deal. It was a killing for alleged hire or a witness. It was one of Lorain County's snitches that was killed. Obviously, they talked to them very personally, and they wanted to get a venue in Lorain County. That would be my guess as to why they actually tried to do that.
Thank you.
Hopefully, I've answered your questions, Judge. Justice with regards to that. Let me briefly go back to the 803 evidence that came in, this batch of conspiracy evidence. The 803 evidence that came in this case was extremely damaging. You have statements from the citizens about Andy Smith wanting to hire, I think two or three people testified that Andy Smith wanted to hire them to kill an individual. You have Andy Smith trying to buy poison. You have Andy Smith showing up at his home, turning his family. All of this has been under 801 as a conspiracy. However, as the court has recognized in the state, which is Carter, and also the court of appeals has recognized in the state, which is Milo. Before you can get to the issue of the question of conspiracy, you first have to have a showing. You have to have independent proof of conspiracy, and that has to be established prior to the evidence coming in. I think in this case, that is not independent showing of conspiracy. As a matter of fact, the co-conspirator of this alleged conspiracy was acquitted. So the question becomes, do you have conspiracy under Ohio law? Because you're aware there's two or more people undertaking an illegal act. In this case, the one was acquitted. You have one person, therefore no conspiracy. However, all of this evidence came in at the Stanley Wallowitz trial. Which should not have been admitted. And I say that simply because under the law, of course, is where there has to be a showing up front. There has to be some kind of ground rule. There has to be a foundation requirement for any of the co-conspiracy testimony to come in. And that's clear under the Ohio law, which was not done in this case. I think that the evidence did come in, statements by Danny Smith with regards to what transpired. And in this case, given the limited factual background that there is, it was extremely damaging to Stanley DeLauro. That being said, I guess there's a time that I know reserve, if there are no further questions, I would reserve my time left for the or the above.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Good morning. Please report. My name is Jonathan Rosenbaum. But I'm to appear on behalf of the appellee in this case. The first thing I would like to address is assignment of error for proposition of law number one. It has been stated both in the brief and this morning in the argument that a proven problem exists because a confession was adduced into evidence against the defendant or the appellant in this case. First of all, I would like to point out that this is in no way, shape, or form a confession. The tapes, which were admitted into evidence only in rebuttal in the penalty phase, actually are a denial and twisting of the facts and allege a self-defense theory by Raymond Smith, indicating that Ronald Lally was the guilty party or the criminally culpable person. It was offered only in the rebuttal phase as a result of the defendant, the appellant Stanley Jalloway, claiming that Detective Lydon coerced people to testify against him, and the tapes clearly demonstrate that Raymond Smith came forward after Danny Smith came forward voluntarily on their own in an attempt to weave this fabrication, which everybody recognized to be a fabrication, which it was portrayed in no other way a fabrication, and therefore not a confession, an attempt to extricate themselves from subsequent drug involvement. No way did the state bring this into its evidence in the case in chief. In fact, it was only mentioned in the opening statement as part of the recounting of the events that led up to the indictment. It was not offered as any substantive evidence. And I fail to see how any prejudice, or I fail to see really what this argument is premised upon when a realistic representation of the facts is considered. Therefore, the state is arguing it was not admitted to evidence in the case in chief and is not a confession of proof of problem. It was merely mentioned in the opening statement as the sequence of how the case came to be and how the investigation progressed.
Counsel?
Yes.
Could you address proposition law in the letter, page 71 of the brief? The disposition of the other act, and I read the trial transcript of the questions that were asked, and I was pretty troubled that we were having a whole bunch of bad acts thrown at the defendant, that none of which had resulted in conviction or mere allegations or charges, but none had resulted in conviction.
The appellate took the stand actually twice, and he was permitted to retake the stand as a result of some discussions whether or not the state would be permitted to offer rebuttal testimony. The appellate portrayed himself as physically incapacitated as a result of injuries or weakness to his knees to work and or to attempt or commit violent acts. He also portrayed himself as the kind of person that cares for people. In other words, he portrayed himself as the kind of person that would be deserving of mercy because of his good acts. As a result,
I read the transcript, and his testimony on his physical condition was that it came and went, and his testimony on his character really was basically just that my girlfriend had a child and I helped take care of the child. How can he, does this mean that anyone, any defendant that testifies on the family man and I have kids will now be open to everything, every bad act that ever happens to himself, that somehow he wasn't a good family man? And I thought that the direct testimony from the defendant was pretty limited, and you used it as a basis to throw the door wide open on something that was pretty innocuous and limited.
Well, if it's admissible at all on behalf of the appellant, it goes to the issue that he is a good person and deserving of mercy. If that is the case and he chooses to go down that road, then my response is yes. Any bad act that he does that logically refutes that is admissible. I didn't realize, and I don't think the law is, and this court proved similar conduct in the McNeil case, that it's not a question of, well, he didn't do it a whole lot, or he only did a little bit, therefore the irrelevance is defined with only tiny amounts for him. This is an adversarial proceeding in which the defendant chose to portray himself and offer certain evidence, and the state is entitled to bring to muster any evidence it has that logically is relevant to that, and did so. So
pretty much any time a person takes a stand to testify at all, that will throw open the door, because that's a family man, and we're going to have to go
there. He says that I am, he portrays himself, as was argued in even McNeil, the kind of person that brings good or joy to other people's lives, then I think it is quite fair to show the other side of the coin that he does things that are inconsistent with being a family man, inconsistent with the responsibilities of the family, inconsistent with the good that you've caused humanity. Yes,
he could be a good family person and go out and drink at night and have a bar fight, he could be told this thing. And if he introduced testimony that in fact he wasn't a good young man and he abused his child or abused his girlfriend, I would see this in effort. But that was just such a leap from that statement, I take care of my girlfriend's child, to okay, but you actually fight in barbary.
Well, I believe that your summary of Mr. Jowler's testimony is not quite all encompassing, but I also believe that the purpose of a two-phase trial is that these issues can be totally explored by the jury without tainting the guilt-finding process. The purpose of a separate, segregated penalty phase is so that all the evidence that is relevant to a point can be brought in without prejudice, over prejudice of the jury in the guilt phase, and that's what was done here. Turning to the appellant's second proposition of law, the state wishes to point out that, first of all, it did establish the independent existence of a conspiracy through a prima facie case in this case. And in this case, I managed to put into the record, albeit at the penalty phase, that Michael Smith's deposition, which laid out the entire events of the evening, as seen by his perspective, was a part of the record available to the court for consideration if there was the conspiracy that was established by independent evidence or prima facie case. The state has also outlined in the brief that it demonstrated that Ronald Lally was, in fact, informed in cases that the murder did indeed occur on the early morning hours of the day the trial was supposed to start against Danny Smith and Raymond Smith. The state did introduce evidence that an officer was called to the scene where there were threats taking place. And based upon all that, the state feels it did establish through independent evidence of prima facie case that a conspiracy existed. The fact that Danny Smith was later acquitted in a subsequent trial is irrelevant and does not eliminate him from being part of this conspiracy. The fact that happened certainly does not rule out that others were involved in the conspiracy besides Danny Smith, including Stanley Jell, who played an integral part of the evening's events and was the person who was in charge of bringing the victim to the obtaining of a car to a secluded spot in the country where Raymond Smith and Michael Smith could enter the car, abduct the victim at gunpoint, and take him on to Cleveland where he was eventually killed. This shows, obviously shows the prior calculation and design occurred in Lorain County. It was expressed that Danny Smith said to Terry Hopkins that this person was killed because he wore a wire against me. Michael Smith clearly testified that once in the car in Lorain County when they first got in the car or at some time in the car that you, why did you set up my son? There's no doubt that any logical viewing of the facts in this case in its entirety without piecemealing them demonstrates that the conspiracy existed which intended to kill Ron Elliott and Bean in the corner on the day his trial was to take place. As the defense counsel, the public counsel has obviously argued this morning, that there was a test of high blood people which occurred in Lorain County, attempts to secure poison which occurred in Lorain County, and threats made. All these things not only were offered properly under the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule, but also demonstrate the prior calculation design clearly occurred in Lorain County, and the case was properly brought there.
Was there any evidence presented to why Jello would get involved? This wasn't his fight, it wasn't his trial, it wasn't, he pretended or protested that he barely knew these folks. What came out of evidence on why he would participate in this murder?
Well, as you know, motive is not required to be proved by the state in any case, and as you pointed out, it's undeniable the events that occurred that he participated in.
I understand that the reason I'm asking that is almost all of the evidence you present about co-conspirator doesn't even mention him. All the threats that initially were made, and all concerns of Smith and what the Smith did, they don't mention Stanley. So a lot of the co-conspirator evidence doesn't mention Stanley at all, or Jill at all. So trying to find out where you're connected with the jail was in the picture.
My connect is that he actively participated in and had to be intricately aware of the planning of the events that led to the murder or assassination of Ronald Lally. He was in charge of picking up the victim. He took him to a place where the car was secured from, and he played pool there with the victim until he received the tape. Then he drove the victim straight out into the country where he drove the car then to the scene of the death, then left and came back and admitted that they had done it. The only evidence adduced in the trial is that he concerned why, which again, it need not be proved, is that he was a close associate with these people, and for some reason, I guess, elected to help his friend. Whether the state can prove what went through his head to commit these twisted acts, I think, is not required. The fact of the matter is, it's undeniable that he did.
So before you sit down, could you refresh my recollection on what the acts are in the Justice Department? What are the acts of this attorney that put venue for his case in the Lorain County?
Well, as I said, he participated in the chasing events that got him to find out where he was so he could be abducted and killed. The defendant went, secured a car, well actually he was with the person by the name of Brian Howington. The car used was owned by Brian Howington and Kareem Fight.
And what evidence did you put forward that indicated that he was aware at any time during the events that he participated in Lorain County, that those activities that he conducted in Lorain County were designed to secure the death of the public.
The biggest part of that would be upon his return to Lorain County with Raymond Smith, he admitted his involvement in what was done.
What did you show that he knew? At what point did he know?
That's the objection.
The victim was going to be murdered.
Well, I think the overall conclusion can only be drawn, is that as a result of the intricate events that led up to Ron Lally's demise and his participation, including, which I'm attempting to, he got the car with Brian Howington, he went to get Ronald Lally, they stole crack cocaine at Ronald Lally's apartment, he took Ronald and Brian Howington back to join Kareem Fight's house. At that time, they paid full until he received a page. At that time, only he and was out, and he wanted the car. Brian Howington said, wait till my aunt comes back, and you know, he insisted and pretty much took the car with Ronald Lally to a place known to him in the country where Huxley was, where he stopped the car at the right spot, and then Raymond Smith and Mike Smith were able to get in the car, brandish the weapon, and carry out their arrest. So I think it is a fair, logical, and practically refutable conclusion that he was involved in the entire event. And then when the gun fired once, parts were found and failed, he got out of the car and helped finish the act, so then Smith followed up to help. According to Michael, he didn't say, come out and help me kill this guy, or come out and hey, guess what? He said, come out and help me, and he did so.
Okay.
You don't think it's an extremely important aspect of the venue in Lorain County?
Absolutely not. There's only one logical conclusion that, you know, this argument was strenuously argued to the jury, which is refuted. An overall look at the state's case, with, you know, how piecemealing it, as has sometimes been suggested, leads to only one conclusion, and that is that everybody knew what was going on and played a role in getting this man to where they were.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenbaum. Mr. Ray, you've saved about 13 minutes of your time.
Just a slight little follow up on what you were just talking about here. The question is whether or not venue for the murder lied in Lorain County or Cuyahoga County. That's what he's charged with murder, he's charged with kidnapping, he's not charged with anything else. The question is whether the murder lied in Cuyahoga County or Lorain County. If you look at the facts that Mike Smith testified to, if there was any kind of continued course of conduct in this case, in other words, something happened in Lorain County, it ceased before they left Lorain County, because at that point in time, Raymond Smith got out of the car. He went in, bought gas, took the gun. Everybody Michael Smith testified that at that point in time, everybody was, I don't know, smoking crack, drinking beer. If there had been any kind of a plan formed, and I'm not saying there was, I don't believe that the evidence is in the trial supports the theory that there was a plan formulated in Lorain County.
If the jury believed that the plan had been formed in Lorain County, you would concede that because an element of the crime occurred in that county, that the venue statutes would permit venue to be in that county.
Well, looking back on this case decision, State versus Smith, or Serena Smith, mm-hmm. I would have to agree and concur in that. But they still bear the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt with regards to standing to all of them. This is a separation case for Smith. The jurisdiction might have lied there for Smith, Daniel Smith, because obviously he was the one that had the weapon. He was the one that formulated the plan, Daniel Smith, Mike Smith, all of this other evidence that came out of the trial. That doesn't happen to stand. And I think it's important to remember that this testimony that came out of the trial was that Stan knew the victim in this case, I believe testimony that I believe came from Stanley Waterbury, but I think the testimony was that Ron Langley, in this case, was a friend of Stanley Waterbury. I believe that the evidence supports the theory that this was probably an attempt to get Ron Langley on the bus.
But if it also must support, I mean, it was found by the jury. I mean, the jury agreed that venue was proper in Lorain County.
But I still think this court can review that finding.
Under what standard?
Well, I still think the sufficiency argument with regards to the issue of reasons of the act element of the offense of murder.
Venue's, again, you just, Douglas already went through that with you, saying venue isn't an element of the crime.
I thought I said, well, just Douglas, I thought venue wasn't an element of the crime.
Okay.
The state doesn't have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. It's part of the element of the court code.
Okay.
That the venue wants, and it's supposed to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So my thought is that Raymond Smith is separate from this case, and I know it's for Raymond Smith, but I still think this court has to find it's not to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there's an issue of venue as relates to Stanley Waller. And the murder occurred in Cuyahoga County. Any intent was hand-formulated would have taken place in Cuyahoga County. Because we're doing the lines in the case. Let me follow up. I'm just expanding with regards to your comments with regards to the evidence the other act that came off trial. I think that what that basically does, my review of this transcript, that basically totally prohibits a defendant taking a stand and in any way explaining to the jury why they shouldn't kill him. And that's my concern in this case. If Stanley, this is the prosecutor was right, Stanley could take the case twice. Number one, he gave a constant statement, and they brought him back, and he gave a statement to Paris Avenue as far as the other actions. The reason he had to do that was to court below and say, hey, I'm going to let it in. This goes to his character. It doesn't go to his character. It never put his character in his evidence. The fact that he testified, hey, you know what, I'm a good person, I take care of a stepson and I have a girlfriend, doesn't rise to the level of assault and arson and all these other acts he was not convicted of. His comment was never, hey, you know what, I've never been convicted of a crime. It was never his comment. But the judge ruled, the court ruled, well, hey, it's fallen to the letter, and on that basis, then we're going to take a stand to make a continuing constitutional statement.
Could I ask you about that a little bit, counsel? Because that again makes the tries to make the point that it is somehow a proportional analysis the courts must do. And I, you know, in speaking about what our job is with regard to those other acts, it sounds like your suggestion is that there has to be some proportional relationship between what the defendant says. That arguably opens a door. The door only opens so wide, depending on the, you know, how much he says about I'm. If his point is, I'm a good guy, then doesn't that open the door for evidence to the contrary?
My thought would be this: just given the sworn statement in this case, okay, given this case, I cannot believe that the testimony presented by Stanley Waller ever opened the door to kind of what he meant.
But we have to be specific in terms of, you know, we can say, well, we sort of feel that way, but we want some kind of standard. And if you say, what would the standard be? I suppose I have thought that the standard is what was the purpose of that testimony from the defendant or the state. Anytime, either way, it goes. So the defendant's purpose in inserting that testimony is what is the standard by which we judge what can come in response.
Well, the Ohio legislature, when it reenacted the death penalty, gave the defendant the opportunity to make an informed statement. I guess I'm not sure what exactly you're looking for, yes, with regards to the standard. I think that the state, if you're going to bring in rebuttal evidence, I think you have to do it. If you're going to rebut character, you better make sure that it falls under the character. If you're going to bring in Raymond Smith's testimony at the sentencing phase, you've got to have a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that in this case. And once again,
Now, that sounds more like a standard. I mean, you're saying there's, you're saying there was no foundation for the admission of this.
Number one, I don't believe there was a foundation for the rebuttal introduction of Marina Smith's testimony as to the statements at the sentencing. I don't think there, obviously, through them, you have to have a foundation, but there wasn't.
And I think that we, the argument is it's impeachment. It's in, we're impeaching what he said. That doesn't meet the standard.
I would definitely not, with all due respect to this cook, I would definitely not agree that this is an impeachment testimony. If a defendant gets on the stand and says, hey, I'm innocent,
sure.
That doesn't open the door to everything coming in against him, including the court of the state. That would have the first confrontation clause. Sixth Amendment says you have a right to confrontation. Lively or versus Virginia, or Cooley versus Virginia, this court should have a right to gather the government in this case. With regards to the other acts, with regards to the assaults, the arson, everything else that came in. Reading the transcript, I'm sure you get a feel for the fact that that just sucked the life out of any mitigation that might have been presented in that case. You can't say this was not error. My thought would be that this, you would never raise, never say this was not error. Based upon the fact that the court ruled that all this other act was committed, it just, any hope that Chihuahua had of mercy in this case, any hope that Chihuahua had of a sentence lasting in death, I think was effectively defeated by the admission of the other act, as well as the admission of Raymond Smith's testimony, statements. And Raymond Smith specifically stated in the second statement that the one who was with his family was the one who was involved in this murder. I think those facts given together, I think, especially with the story of mitigation of the state, I think the court permitted to come in with the error in this case. Chief Justice Moyer, members of the court, I just want to thank you for your time explaining there are no further questions beyond the time.
Thank you.
Everything happened.
Thank you.